Good afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices. I'm your host, Fred Monroe. Glad you're with us today. I want to remind you that we do this so you will get a better picture of what's going on the Central Coast and what's going on in our community. Our goal is to provide you with credible and valid information and insights from diverse members of our community and diverse topics. Central Coast Voices wants to address, and hopefully we do a very good job of it for you, how today's choices will affect tomorrow's community and how we look at the long-term ramifications of changes in our community. And we're indeed going to look today at a long-term ramification of a change. And it's been a significant change. I want to remind you that this is community radio. This is public radio, and you're part of that discussion. So the phone number is 805-781-3875. That's 781-3875. We want you to be part of the discussion, and hopefully you'll find this interesting enough to be part of that for us. We're going to talk today about a topic that we briefly spoke about a year and a half ago when the sheriff was in the studio and we talked about some things with the sheriff's department, and that's the evolution of prison, what's been called prison realignment in California. Actually, for some people at the state level, they would refer to it as prison realignment. There are people at the local level who might look at it as the state of California, to save money, decided to slough an awful lot of people who used to be in state incarceration facilities or state programs of some kind off on the counties. The good news from my perspective as someone not in law enforcement, but who's somebody who's looked at this topic and we've talked about it before, is that even though it's been expensive for counties and in some cases cumbersome, there have been some good effects and some surprisingly positive things that have come out of it, even though it's been frustrating for a lot of folks. My guest today, or Clark Guest, he's the program supervisor for criminal justice treatment with San Luis Obispo County's Drug and Alcohol Services. Tim Olivas, who's the under-sheriff of the San Luis Obispo County, and then Robert Reyes, who is the assistant chief probation officer. And they all have different aspects of the same topic they deal with. For those of you who may not have thought of this, one of the key things that's a factor for the sheriff's department is that the county jail in San Luis Obispo County, and probably in most counties, is directly under the auspices of the sheriff's department. I will tell you this, that I'm going to not pick on, but I'm going to mention that Robert Reyes came up with the specific bit of information that I thought is something that we need to start this off with, and that is that this has been, in his mind, the most significant change in the criminal justice system in 30 years in California. That's 30 years. That's really been a big factor, and I think that Robert brought that up. We'll get into it in just a couple of minutes. Before we get into the discussion, Clark Guest, who is one of our guests, when he sent an email to me with some information on it, I noticed at the bottom, I love to read what people add to the bottom of emails. In this case, I suspect it sits in all of his emails because it was under his signature, and it was a quote by Mark Twain. And it was, habit is habit, and not to be flung out the window by any man, but coaxed downstairs a step at a time. And I think that I appreciate the fact that one of my guests is the one that shared that with me. But I think it's also, I wanted to mention it because I think to some extent it probably applies to this topic, because there's an awful lot of things that have happened in the law enforcement community, as I understand this topic, that in the past has been a factor of when someone gets out of incarceration at a state institution or a federal institution, pretty much booting them out the door, giving them back whatever they came in with, which wasn't a whole lot probably, and saying, you're on your own, go get home, or here's a bus ticket back to nowhere. And to some extent, that hasn't been very effective. So even though this program has been expensive, I think in some ways, to my perspective, and these guys might correct me later on, an effective way of getting people a little closer to home as we deal with them. So I'm going to start off with Robert. Robert, let's talk about that specific comment from you, which is, it's the most significant criminal justice policy reform in 30 years in California.
Yeah. Thank you, Fred, for having me here this afternoon. I believe that. I think if you go back, and I want to make this a history lesson, but in the mid-70s through the 80s, I mean, criminal justice policy, much of it was focused on punishment and incarceration. So when I say it's the most significant reform in 30 years, I think in part public safety realignment is not only a California experiment, it's been done in other states, is really in part a reaction to some of the unintended consequences of those policies. And much of it is centered around overcrowding in our state prisons, and also with California experiencing an economic recession for the 5-6 years ago, with state budgets and local county budgets being shrunk because of that, I think it was sort of the perfect storm that led to some of that reform.
Yeah. One of the local paper in San Luis Obispo County, the Tribune, a couple of months ago, did some rather extensive, I want to say kind of case studies or snapshots about some specific individuals who had been affected by this program. There, the public, and when this first came about, there was a lot of discussion, oh, this is just going to dump a whole bunch of nuisance criminals, but ones who aren't very dangerous, in the lap of the county government because the state doesn't want to pay to incarcerate them anymore. But some of the vignette and snapshot material that was presented in the paper gave a pretty clear picture that sometimes having people closer to home gets you a better chance to work with them so they don't end up back there again.
No, I didn't. Absolutely. Many of the inmates that have been released back to our county, a lot of have lived here their whole life. And I think in part public safety realignment really helps to sort of give back some local control to our county agencies, our law enforcement agencies, our community partners to really, I think at the ground level, we know what strategies work. We know what some of our needs are of our criminal population. So I think it does help that they have the ability to access local services that are operated by our local agencies.
The flip side is that someone who's out on probation, whether they're out on probation from a state facility or a local facility, in the case of the jail, you're going to have to deal with anyway. You're the local people they come back to. So I'm going to bring Tim into the discussion now because obviously the sheriff's department has to pay for a way to continue to incarcerate people that they may not have ever had to incarcerate before.
Well, yeah, thanks, Fred. Thanks for having me here. AB 109 really created some challenges as far as the custody side of the state population of the non-serious, non-violent, non-sex offenders that were now pushed to the county level. Where that created some challenges for us was the population size. So when it was implemented in 2011, we saw a steady increase of our average daily population. And you got to understand that part of AB 109 was not just transferring that population, but it also transferred the sentences. Prior to AB 109, the longest time anybody spent in county jail was a year. We have some people currently incarcerated that have 7-year, 8-year sentences. I believe Santa Barbara has a 21-year sentence. LA has a 44-year sentence. Those facilities at the county levels were never designed to be for long-term stay. So those are some of the challenges we've had to address with the population size increasing, as well as the sophistication of the inmates that are there now. We used to refer to it as state prison was kind of college. County jail was maybe high school. So now you have college degrees coming and educating criminal activity at the county level, which is not just these, you know, more serious crimes, I'll say, but also you have, you know, drunken publics and drunk drivings, first-time offenders intermixed with this population too. So I'd say those are some of the challenges is that criminal sophistication. They bring that knowledge of smuggling stuff into prison, but it's also about opportunities. And I think that's the whole other half of AB9, even for the law enforcement side, is the cooperative relationships that we've built now to deal with, just as you were talking about and Robert was, about getting them successfully So they don't come back. And that's our goal, is we don't want to see them back. So it's that handoff with drug and alcohol service. We start a jail programming unit. The same three here at this table right here is in our jail programs unit that is now inside the custody facility working with the inmates directly.
Okay. So this may be in the category of the kind of thing that a law enforcement officer doesn't want to answer on a radio show, but I'll ask it anyway. Are you happier with the result than you expected to get when you first knew this was going to get thrown on you, or has it worked out not as well as you would have liked to have believed?
I think it's a little of both of those. I think originally for law enforcement there was a lot of concern and a lot of fear the release of these inmates now that used to be at state prison, the county level, and then getting out, whether they were on state parole, now they're on probation. There was a lot of fear that crime rates were really going to go up, having this population out there. I don't think that the data shows that now that we've had some years under our belt. I think an example for probation is I think the caseloads were actually higher, meaning how many parolees a parole agent had to supervise, as opposed to breaking it down to the county level and how many now people on probation that are PRCSs, their caseload. So there's actually probably more supervision at a certain level out there. The challenges for us on the custody side of the house, which the sheriffs have to deal with, that's been a challenge, is dealing with that sophistication and kind of bringing that prison mentality into, the county jail and the long-term sentences, because some things, long-term medical care. And being able to offer tests for diagnoses that, we never would have thought of when we just had to have a year in custody was the maximum amount of time.
As you're mentioning that, one of the things that came to mind for me is let's pick, because it's easy and it's nearby and it's actually in the listening area, Soledad. Okay. How many inmates are there, round figures? Do you have any idea at Soledad?
No, I don't. Okay. I don't know that. No.
But talking about affiliated with at least a couple of thousand, I would assume. Okay.
Usually state prisons are again.
How many current inmates do you have in the county of San Luis Obispo who would be in a state prison if we didn't have this program in place?
I could tell you that before AB 109, our average daily population was around the 500s, five to mid 500s. We saw a steady increase after AB 09, about 100 a year. So prior to Prop 47, which was another dynamic shift, we had increased to about 700 to 740 inmates.
Okay. Because what comes to mind for me is that you're talking about things you have to deal with, like things getting smuggled in. You mentioned in some of the information you sent me that you guys now have a more extensive body scanner situation, and you have canine patrol teams that work with things that may be contraband in there. But it occurred to me on a daily basis, you may be seeing the person who comes in to visit inmate C. Is probably the same person you're going to see once a week or once every couple of days, or it's, wife and daughter that come to visit dad. So you're going to see those same people, and you're going to see them. So you're working with a smaller population of variables, if you will. But the person who is that inmate that's in there, they're going to see people who are family or close friends or whoever's allowed to see them more often if they're near home. Does that give you any trade-off on the kind of behavior problems you have? So someone who may be a discipline problem in Soledad may be less of a discipline problem, hopefully, when he sees his kids more often. And I don't know if this is a big factor.
I could tell you that I think it plays both ways. a little bit? I think there's definitely, and I think there's even data out there that shows connection with the family helps them get over their addictions. And jail is not a fun place. So anytime they could have some joy brought into their life, you know, that's good. So I think there are family members that utilize that for the proper purposes. With the more sophistication of the inmates, we also have family members and friends that continue on with a criminal element that they carry from the inside to the outside. So that connection kind of works both ways. I would like to think, I'm a little bit of an optimist, that it works more for the better than it does the worse. Some of the things we've done, one of the new things the sheriff's added to actually assist and even help those that may not have local family even, is we're introducing video visitation into the jail. So it's one thing to be able to call, you know, and talk to the families. But as you said, when they come and visit and have that face-to-face, which is still a glass partition, now they could do video visitations from their cells and have that family connection, because we do recognize that as being important and probably provides more good than it does the negative side.
Yeah, the prison version of Skyping, if you will.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. Before you jump, let me just remind folks, this is a discussion we'd like you to be part of, too, if you would like. Oftentimes, the discussion gets shifted a little bit based upon what you, as listeners, may want to talk about or may want to bring onto the table. The phone number is 781-3875. That's 805-781-3875. We'd like you to be part of the discussion. Robert, jump in.
Yeah, I just kind of wanted to follow up what Tim said. I think another advantage, I think, is probation officers. We know many of the inmates that are released back out of state prison. Many of them have been on probation before. So we have the advantage of having sort of a historical relationship with them, knowing their families. And even some we may have known as they were juveniles in the system. So I think that gives us an advantage in working with them. I just sort of wanted to point that out as well.
Yeah, that brings up a good point, though. And when looking through some of the notes I have here, I guess prior to this realignment, you had a recidivism rate for San Luis Obispo County of about 55%. And the figures for the most recent year, I guess, since this program are that it's realistically down to about 30%, I guess, in some cases. So it may be years before you see that as a real long-term effect on what the prison population is or the jail population. How does that affect what you do on a daily basis, especially in probation? And how does it affect the larger community? Because let's be realistic. This is expensive. We would prefer nobody was incarcerated for any good reason, or any bad reason for that matter. But the reality is we're going to have it there. So if we can find a way to get fewer people who reoffend once they're out, everybody wins, even though it may be expensive to get them there. So how do you see that affecting your probationary population? And is it helping you with staffing?
No, and through public safety realignment, we got state dollars to help fund more probation officer positions. I think probation's mission when it comes to public safety is indeed a priority. How we go about that, I think, is in two ways. One, you know, we want to make sure that those that we supervise in the community are obeying the law and following their terms and conditions. And if they obviously don't want to do that or they become a danger to the public, you know, they are going to be removed to county jail. On the other hand, more of our long-term goal is to really change offender behavior. And if we could, as probation officers, change offender behavior, then we're going to have a lasting impact on public safety. If we could get them to see that a lifestyle change is what needs to happen for them, it benefits all the community.
Okay, great. We didn't get a chance to talk to Clark yet, but we got a caller, and he may actually be something that really is going to come about for Clark's part of this discussion. So hold on a second. And we have Peter. Are you there?
I'm here.
Yeah. Go ahead. What are your thoughts?
Well, I run a construction company, and I try and help people that had drug problems come out of prison, come out of jail, because, you know, we have a rough group anyway. In the construction field, most people have run in with the law one time or another, or with each other, or to their, you know, you have to be tough to be in construction. I say there's no sissies in construction because they get out and they work on computers. And what I've seen firsthand is when people that are on drugs have a job, they do a lot less drugs. So I like that a lot. And I have a philosophy of, you know, I don't even drug test. I'm like, well, I know most of my guys are doing drugs here and there, but as long as they aren't doing them at work, I'm happy, you know, because, hey, it's an outlet for a lot of people, and I've gone through that myself. And I'm of the school of, we got way too many people in jail for drug-related offenses, whether they're buying, selling, using, and instead of being educated and put to work and helping the economy, they're taking a big sucking out of the economic part of the state. And the drug sentences that I've seen come down for people have been crazy, in my opinion, compared to some of the other charges that are, you know, violent charges, because they'll get one or two, but you get law enforcement a lot of times. I don't know whether they're trying to get bounty points by tacking on extra charges, but they'll take every little thing that they find on somebody and tack a whole separate charge for it instead of, hey, this person just caught with some drugs. Yeah, they need some help. They should be in a program. And I don't know if there's anything that you guys can do on the probation level or on the officer's level of trying to get this to reduce these people that are pretty good people, especially the first-time or second-time offenders. I mean, you know, ones that are violent and everything else, yeah, you know, lock them up, whatever. But the ones that are just on drugs, I'm seeing them, like you said, they're getting educated in how to be dishonest. Where I'm trying to educate them in my crew is to be faithful, loyal, and true to my company and true to each other and back each other up and have a support system. And I have a number of people that I've actually helped get off hard drugs that say I've saved their life because I gave them a job and everything else.
Yeah, Peter, you may have done the best intro for us to bring Clark Guest into the discussion. Clark Guest is basically, among other things, the coordinator for the non-incarcerated side of the drug court system in our county. And so I'm going to ask Clark to discuss this a little further. Can you hear us on your radio? So if I drop the call, you can still hear the answer?
Yes, hopefully you won't drop the call.
Okay, good.
But I can turn the radio up.
No,
if the call
that's okay. If the call gets dropped, just go ahead. Yeah, Clark, jump in.
Hey, Peter, and thank you for having me on the show. Peter, first of all, I want to thank you for employing people and giving them a second chance, because it's employers like you to allow people to step up and start making money and have some kind of normal life. And the fortunate thing about AB 109 and how all this came about is the Community Corrections Partnership was able to fund a lot, send a lot of the funding to services to help people when they get out. And, you know, part of those services also includes in custody treatment, but also we have a huge reentry program that starts identifying their needs before they even think about getting out. And we're already working on getting them housing and ID cards and clothing and rides from jail and a place to live. And then as they start stabilizing in with their substance use disorder, we start working on their vocational needs. And unfortunately, a lot of them do come out and have to work construction jobs or low-level jobs, but it starts teaching them to be responsible, and a lot of them do go back to school and become pretty successful. And so it's the old paradigm of when somebody would get out of prison, they'd give them $200 and a bus pass and say, now change your life. This whole thing has really allowed us to come together as a team and identify their needs and, you know, not as much punish somebody for using substances, but what can we do to help you step away from those substances? And so it's a really a team approach. We have meetings with four or five probation officers and clinicians and therapists. And every time there's a need or a gap in services, the corrections partnership will come up. Like, for instance, about a year ago, they noticed a gap with the coexisting disorders people that were were getting out, and they have a substance use disorder and anxiety or schizophrenia, and they were just – there was really nothing to do. So we've hired a full-time therapist to fill that gap. They've just allowed us to hire two more people for out of the jail because they saw a need to start servicing more people out of the jail. Our sober livings have gradually increased year after year because we found that housing people and, you know, that is honest and they don't want to go back to their drug dealer's house to go sleep on the couch actually helps them step out of some of that destruction. And, you know, addiction is so just pulls the people back, as you see probably with your crews.
Oh.
You know, some people can do it for years and never get in any trouble, and then you have some that do it, and boom, they're back in jail.
Well, and the other thing is the meth and the heroin are a lot worse than the weed, than pot and booze, as my experience, because it affects them, makes them sweat, it makes them really hurt, and it's the toughest thing for them to do.
Well,
so they need to be classified in two different ways, and I think the system sometimes just kind of lumps them a little bit. And I'd like to see that separated out a little bit because I think it's a big step. I mean, I'm a big proponent of medical marijuana because I know there's 72 different uses, and I personally have experienced some myself on, you know, on healings and different things from certain things. And I know that there's a big controversy about it, but I see a huge disinterest once people get into the medical marijuana thing. They get a lot less disinterested in something else. I've actually got a program that I've thought of. It's called Go Back Through the Gate because, you know, the DARE program always thought it was a gateway program. And I've always thought, well, you know, it can work both ways. And I've actually had that work. One of my guys that I sent back to New Mexico to look at a ranch for me, and he basically still smokes out there, but he used to be a heavy meth user. And I basically said, you're fired. You go take care of things here and clean up. And he did. He's been working for 8 years now, and he's completely been off of it for years. So I know for a fact that that kind of can work because I've seen it work in my particular.
Peter, thank you very much. I think this has been a very good topic you've brought up, and we'll discuss it a little further in the program also. Thanks for the call.
That's the other one. So thank you so much for that.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you, Peter.
Okay. Clark, I guess we hadn't talked about this, but I something I've just occurred to me we've never discussed, and that is how long has the program specifically that you're doing been going on? And because prior to what the program is that you're involved in with the drug court and dealing with people when they're coming out also didn't exist.
Well, the drug court is sort of separate from the program that we put together, the post-release treatment services program, because as a community partnership was identified, most of these people were coming out with an addiction. An addiction so severe that once they start, they cannot stop. Substance use disorder. So we started slow with one clinician and a couple case managers and had a little program in the San Luis Obispo Clinic. And then they slowly and it was really awesome what they did with this a community because, you know, a lot of communities are having like one day center to report to. Well, with the way this community is laid out with our regions in North County and South County, they created hubs, one in South County, one in San Luis, and one in Paso Robles. And then so we've got separate programs in each of those hubs, the substance use programs, with the coexisting disorder clinician at each one of those programs, and then you throw in the medication-assisted program because, you know, we have a really huge epidemic with opiate use in this county. It's just a really good collaborating program, and then we started with one person out at the jail starting a treatment program out of the jail. Now we have three people out of the jail, and jail programs are great, but mixed with reentry, it's unbelievable. That's where the magic happens. When you actually have somebody picking them up from jail, warm hand off to sober living, bringing them to their clinic, and they've already been in treatment in jail, and they're like head and shoulders above some of the people that haven't had any treatment that are coming out. They know the faces, they know the routine, and it's just a method. It's You know, I mean, fiscal year 14-15, we had a 55% success rate with addiction treatment. You know, anything above 30, you're doing pretty well.
Okay, that's great. Okay, line two. Larry, are you there? Sorry to keep
yes,
you waiting.
I'm here.
Okay, jump on in here.
Yes, I have a question on the new legislation, which I believe has extended the stay in the county prisons. And, you know, I know that the very definition of a felony is a year or more in a state institution. So I'm assuming that felons do not come into the county prison. I mean, the judge sets the sentence, and if it's a felony, a burglary or something like that, they automatically have to go to a state prison. You're not going to get felons here, are you? And so I don't know if I'm right or wrong or what I'm saying. So I see a connection here between the counties throwing away the county hospital. Okay, over the last 10 years that happened, we used to have a county hospital, right? I'm sure, treated a lot of people involved in drugs. And so it seems to be a trend, you know, throughout the nation that we're not going to deal, we're going to put things in prisons. We're dealing more with, it's the growth of prison population, and the county is now going to deal with that. So county money, which used to go to the county hospital, is probably going to law enforcement. Am I wrong about that?
Well, just to, Larry, to answer your question about the question on the felonies, under prison realignment or AB 109, which is what the title of the bill was, judges now could sentence felons to a local prison term to be served in the county jail.
Really?
Yeah, and there's most felonies now often are served in the county jail. There are certain specified felonies, and if you're convicted of a serious or violent felony, you'll still go to state prison. But in general, most felonies are now served in county jail as a prison sentence.
Yeah, I would agree
well,
with that.
That's an important thing to know.
Yeah.
Yes. So the sentences that, and basically what that was is they looked at the non-serious, non-violent, non-sex felony offenses that used to go to state prison now come to the county jail. So that's where you get the longer sentences.
Well, you know, a felony bears with it. You know, you can't vote. You can't. There are lots of things you can't do.
That is correct.
Mm-hmm. So you mean to say now the county jail is a mixture of felons and misdemeanors?
Yes, that's part of the challenges.
What kind of percentage do you have there?
You know, our population, you got to remember that at a county jail, so state prison is all convictions. Everybody that is at a state prison has gone through the court process and been convicted. So our population also includes that group of unsentenced who are here. They were charged with unsentenced because what they're doing.
That would be a misdemeanor, correct?
Misdemeanors and felons, even murders.
Unsentenced felons?
Before they've had a trial.
Did you go to a trial?
Yeah, they come to county jail, and if they don't bail out or if there's no bail, they stay in county jail until they go through the court process and are actually sentenced.
Okay, once they're sentenced,
yes,
and they're a felon.
Correct. Some.
They can stay in the county jail.
Yes, all those, as I said before, the non-serious, non-sex, non-violent sections that were identified in AB 109 that used to go to state prison, now when they're sentenced, they come to the county jails.
Wow.
And
that's quite a change.
And Larry, you had mentioned the county hospital closing.
While yes. By the way, let me say that I think that was a great mistake, but go ahead.
Well, I just wanted, I don't know if you've been by there lately, but it's now the behavioral health health campus, and it is a bustling campus of wellness that is handling our substance use disorder treatment, our coexisting disorder treatment, a mental health treatment.
Does it have any beds?
No. This is all outpatient treatment.
It's all outpatient.
But it is,
the old county hospital, which, you know, dealt with illnesses. Yeah.
There is a facility separate from what Clark's talking about that's attached to the county health department that has 16 beds for short-term hospitalization for mental issues.
Well, do you happen to know whether or not this new system is costing the county as much money as the old county hospital was?
Well, with AB 109, there was state funding that came with it. And originally, it had actually a sunset clause to it, that it was only guaranteed for a certain amount of years. The governor made a promise that he was going to make that long-term funding for it because it was very nervous getting AB 109 and having funding short-term, and then what happens? But actually, legislation was passed, so there is state funding continuous with AB 109.
So in other words, the county now, there's no county funding. This is all state-funded, this ex-county hospital.
Yeah, Larry, under realignment, the state has passed on some of the savings from reducing their prison population to the counties in the form of financial support. So in this particular fiscal year in San Luis Obispo County, so I'm talking about 2015-2016, yeah, we are expected to receive $7.2 million in realignment money that helps to support our increase in staffing, our treatment services that are directed at our prison population.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Larry. Take care.
Thank you.
Okay. This is frustrating. His frustration, I think, is very legitimate, and it goes to part of what Tim was talking about, and that was that you have people who would not normally be in hanging out with your average jail inmate. But it seems to see what to say from all three of you, where we're getting with this is, even though there are some people who are being adversely affected in the community by this kind of move, the numbers are that more people are getting the kind of services they need in transitioning out of jail, which means they're not going to go back as often.
Yeah, you're correct. And, yeah, and Fred, what I wanted to point out, kind of go with Clark had said, one of the things we did soon after realignment was in effect is what we established, what we affectionately call the PROM, which stands for post-release offender meeting. And so when our
could you pick a cleverer name?
Well, yeah, I thought it was pretty clever.
Yeah.
So when they're,
I don't know. I'm sorry, because my first thought is the average guy coming out of jail doesn't think he wants to go to the prom.
No, absolutely. But what happens is when they are released from a prison, they have 48 hours to report to probation. So upon them reporting to probation, they are immediately given an appointment date to attend the prom. At the prom is all our county partners, including Drug and Alcohol, County Mental Health. We have the Department of Rehab. We have our tattoo removal program. We have an employment coordinator that's funded by the probation department. Our probation officers that supervise these cases, they're all in the same room. And we have our partners from Capsule are there who do some of our case management services. So many of these offenders get screened immediately. And I think some of the early results is that more often than our sort of normal probation populations, that we're able to get them into treatment at a much shorter time. So that the wait time is less. We're able to get them into a sober bed if that's what they need to sort of help them with their sobriety. And I know Clark could sort of speak more about this, but we found that this model has been effective in getting them identifying their needs and getting to the appropriate services.
Okay. So before we had this type of program, what happened to that same inmate when they got out?
Well, often,
give us a picture of what that looks
like. Sure, often they would, you know, whether it was jail, back then it was jail, they'd get out of jail, or if they got out of prison, they would report to the parole agent. But often what happened, you'd give them a bunch of different referrals to different services and maybe give them an address, and they were sort of left on their own to get there. And so what happens often, they never get there. They never get to that appointment. They never get down to drug and alcohol services. They never get down to Department of Social Services to enroll into Medi-Cal. Our model now helps them do that. By giving them a case manager, we're able to make that transition much easier for them. Because believe it or not, many of them are not equipped when they come out of prison, and that really comes from their own words, to have to deal with all the things that they have to deal with, whether it's housing, reconnecting with their families, trying to find a job. I think a lot of them want to do good. They don't want to go back to prison. They often don't know how, though, to be successful.
So, yeah, Fred, I think that's a great point. And like Clark mentioned earlier, you know, really, I think the best thing that's come out of AB 109 is the collaboration and the cooperation. You know, at the jail, we've always offered some programs, but we have certainly escalated that up with the whole jail programs unit. We're working, as the one caller, I believe it was Peter, called in and talked about construction. You know, we have a welding program with a local union. We're working with the Carpenters Union. We're working with local restaurants, trying to get them vocational skills. But as Clark mentioned, that's while they're in custody and they're kind of a captive audience. I mean, we take them to work every day and we bring them home. You know, so it's that warm handoff. But I can't say there's one government entity or one group that's really the success. I think it's us all working together and having drug and alcohol come in, having probation doing what they're doing. And we have several private community partners that are involved with this too, like Restorative Partners and Transitions Mental Health, that are doing programs and helping what we call with that warm handshake, that handoff. Because when they do leave the jail, they've been in a very controlled environment. We've been controlling their life, giving them that structure. They've been successful. The hardest part is to get them back into society as productive members. So starting it there and then working with the other government entities and the private entities, I think that's the best thing that's coming out of AB 109.
Let me remind you, this is a discussion we're having about AB 109 and prison realignment and how it's affected our local community. It sounds like it's affected them positively in most cases. We'd like you to be part of the discussion. We have a few minutes left. The phone number is 781-3875. That's 805-781-3875. This is Public Radio KCBX. This is Central Coast Voices. And you're part of that discussion if you choose to be. So give us a call. You know, one of the caller who was concerned about it actually shocked that there were felons with long-term sentences that were now being shifted over permanently to the county jail for their time. What are you able to do with, for lack of a better word, a problem inmate that got shifted back over because it was a nonviolent crime? They were, you know, how is their candidacy to be part of this program ascertained at the state level? And if they get here and you're saying, oh, this person is just going to be a constant problem, they're prone to outbursts of violence and anger, they're prone to get in constant arguments and disagreements with other inmates, and we would like them to go back to the state, how do you address that?
There is no way to address that.
I'm very sorry to hear that. I am truly sorry to hear that.
And you bring up a good point, though. You know, a lot of these programs, they're voluntary. You know, they have to be willing and want to participate. There's no forced programming or vocational skills. So hopefully, you know, when they come into that correctional environment, there are some that don't want to be involved and they just want to do their time and move on and do what they do. But I think what we're focusing on is that population that may be at a point in their life or may have got, you know, they're not bad people. They may have made bad decisions, which got them to where they are, and they're ready to make that change. And some of the programs are focused just on that, alternatives to violence, cognitive behavioral type, you know, programming to get them think before you react along those lines, because that's a lot of times what's gotten them in there, in addition to the addictions, you know, of the alcohol and drugs at times, or combinations of both.
Yeah. Clark, on your side, dealing with major anger management issues and things like that, do you have tools for that in the program?
Well, we do. But you have to understand that for years, people were getting out of prison or custody and being asked to change without any tools. And we're, as multi-agencies, are giving them those tools beforehand and when they get out. And, you know, cognitive behavioral change is huge because, you know, they've been like this for a long time. They're thinking, you know, I mean, I was doing a group last night and we were talking about criminal codes. They come out with these criminal codes that have worked for 20 years because they're alive. They've survived. And so they come out and one thing goes wrong, they're going to go back to that criminal thinking, that criminal code. And so we're trying to break some of those behavioral changes. And I've been doing this a long time. And so our job as a multi-agency is trying to get somebody in the right program at the right time of their life. And if we can do that, then something magical happens, and we never see them back in this stuff. And before you know it, they're coming back, and they're speaking to our groups, and they're like role models to sustain this change. But, you know, you never know when somebody's ready. You know, we just give them chances, and eventually when they're ready and getting tired of, you know, going back to jail or committing crimes, or their loved ones are not seeing their kids. You know, the opposite is true. As we put, you know, families are brought back together, and our community is reunited by the things that happen. And it might start with when they go to jail. That's an intervention. Those are interventions. Life has interventions. When you call in sick for work or you stop going to school, they just don't listen until some of the interventions get a little bit tougher.
Brings up a point, and I maybe either Robert or Clark have some insights to this, and it may just not be something that you have to address on a regular basis. But if you have somebody, because we have we know of gang activity in San Luis County. We're smack dab in the center of the coast, and people, it's a lot going on here. If you have somebody who says to you in either probation or one of the drug and alcohol services programs that Clark's involved in, that, you know, I need to get out of this town. Everybody I know, everybody I've been raised with since I was 10 years old is either a gangbanger or a thug. And I would like to, you know, can I go live in, I don't know, Salinas instead of here? And how do you address that concern? That may be a proactive style that the average returning inmate doesn't have, but I think it may be a factor for some of them.
No, sure, Fred, and that happens from time to time, not just with living a gang lifestyle, but maybe from they want to stop using drugs. I think it's really important whether you're a probation officer, a correctional officer at the jail, or a drug and alcohol counselor. I think one of the important things, you have to meet each inmate where they're at. When they come out, they're in a certain place. For some, maybe they've hit rock bottom, they want to change. For others, they're going to resist everything that we want to do with them, even if you list out all the great things that are going to come out of it. So I think it's important we meet them where they're at in their life. I think secondly, and I think all three of our agencies have done a good job of speaking a common language around really adopting what in our field is called evidence-based practices, you know, doing the things that research shows that works with this population. So, you know, one of the things is identifying who's at most risk of committing another crime and targeting that particular population with the resources that we have, you know, developing case plans so they have targeted, specific goals that they're going to meet that's really going to help them change their behavior, get a job, get off drugs, whatever it is. So I think and then as a probation officer, you have to try to facilitate that change. You can't do it for them, but you could definitely help facilitate that change. And sometimes we use the carrot, and sometimes, you know, we use the stick to sort of use that analogy.
Okay, we've got a couple minutes. I want to get in here real quick. Joe, you there? Are you there, Joe? You're on the air. Okay, go ahead. Sorry. I know you had to wait a couple of times and had to go, so you've got a couple of minutes. Jump in here.
Yeah, no problem. The question I have is I have a youth, first time going to prison out of Santa Barbara County. And they're sending him to Mississippi. And the question I have is, why do they do that? And you were talking about how it helps have family close to them. There's no way family's going to, you know, be able to go all the way over to Mississippi. So can you have any ideas of why they would send him to something like that?
Well, I don't have an idea about that particular case. I know that I don't know if there's, he's been sent to prison. I don't know. I mean, I know at one point the California Department of Corrections often contracted beds out of state to help ease their population. If they're on probation, there's a legal means if they want to move out of the county or out of state that we have to go through if they have family someplace else. But I really can't. Other than that, I really can't answer that question.
All right. Well, thanks for your time.
Sorry. Thanks for asking. Sorry we don't have an answer for you. Yeah, it's maybe, I don't know, possibly a federal crime or something like that.
Yeah,
it's
federal, too.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry we don't have an answer to that. We've had some good answers here, and I appreciate that. Before we wrap things up, are there any parts of this specifically that are missing that you want the state to help you with?
Well,
not that we expect the state to help you with a lot, I realize. But
no, I think from sort of statewide probation sense is number one. And I think that the chief probation officers of California have done a really good job of working with the governor's office and the legislature to protect the realignment dollars. Mm-hmm. And I know as well as with the California Sheriff's Association, it's done a great job of that strong working relationship with the governor to protect those dollars. And I think long term, that's what we want to have. They continue to have those dollars flow to the counties so that we could meet the needs of our local population.
Yeah. Good answer. And we, you know, we've had some people on, and we've talked about things like Homeboy Industries and things like that large organizations have done. I would hope that sometime we can see more things like that in counties like ours, even though we're considered a rather rural population for programs like that. But we've also, Sister Teresa's been on here talking about her program.
Restorative Partners.
Yeah, Restorative Partners.
And the things that they've done. In fact, it's been over a year and a half since she was on the program. Mm-hmm. We'll have to talk about that again because what they've done is phenomenal.
Great. Teresa's done remarkable work. One of the things I want to kind of leave, Fred, is that one of the challenges we had early on is essentially we were flying a plane that we were building at the same time. So there were a lot of unknowns. And I think with that, we've done a great job, as Tim spoke about, our collaboration. Our working relationship is solid, both at the executive and operations level of each of our departments. But it's challenging to try to build something that we really didn't have no idea to know what the impacts were going to be.
Mm-hmm. Most of your probation officers happy with what they have to work with from a program like this? Luckily, they don't have to do the budgetary stuff. So they just look at what works in the field.
No, it's hard to know what the probation officers, you know, I mean, as the assistant chief, you know, they probably tell me more what I want to hear. But generally, we have fantastic probation officers in this county.
We'll take anonymous calls after the program and send them over to you without any names on them. Probably.
They do a fantastic job with sometimes a very difficult population. I think for those that work on the adult side of things, they realize we have much more services and dedicated funding to sort of help them facilitate that change with the offenders they supervise. So.
Okay. Anyway, any final thoughts you want to make sure people are aware of, Robert, before I ask the same question of my other guests? Okay, you summed up very well for us. Thank you.
Well, no, I think it's just – I think, you know, is it going to work? I think it's too early to tell. You know, some of the early studies done by Public Policy Institute of California, and, you know, shows realignment's had some effect. There's been some marginal crime increases, but it's hard to say that's contributed to realignment. I think it's early to tell. But I think I feel confident here in San Luis Obispo County. We're doing a great job. The recidivism rate is low.
Yeah.
And so I'm pleased with that.
Okay. Yeah.
I'll just chime in on that. I think we live in a wonderful county. I think the collaboration at the government level and with the private sector, as you mentioned, Sister Teresa, and there's several other groups, and with our vocational and reaching out to the Welders Union and all that has been phenomenal. And although we may have been building a plane as we were flying it, I think in this county we've built one heck of a plane. Yeah. With where we're headed with it and have been very successful. As far as our staff, probably had some of the most significant challenges and changes on the custody side of things because even though we had some programming, it was more just housing because it was short term. Yeah. So it's been a real mind shift for them getting into a programming aspect, long term, you know, reentry. And they've done a phenomenal job on both sides of that with dealing with the challenges we talked about with the smuggling of drugs and the sophistication in prison politics, but they've also been very adaptable and embraced and have some amazing success stories on the side of the programming and reducing the recidivism rate. Yeah. So.
One quick question that I forgot to ask that because it may affect. How often is an inmate that's just been sentenced to something handed off to you? Or they generally go to state prison first and then they're evaluated at that level, but oftentimes you get them
All the sections that came with AB 109 that used to go to state prison automatically come. They no longer go to state prison
Unless there's a history of violence or other.
Well, there's a lot of sections that still go to state prison, never make it to the county level. Okay. But the ones related to AB 109 come directly to the county.
Okay. Clark, we get to kind of wrap up with you. How do you see this going, and what do we want to make sure people know about that they may not have known before?
Well, I just think that, you know, substance use disorders continue to affect our communities and our system, and this systematic approach that's bringing multi-agencies together, multi-systems together, is actually working. I mean, you know, I see it on the ground level with families getting reunited and people getting off of probation and you know, then coming back and getting their charges, working their charges out. And we just need to continue to stay on top of this ball game because it's an ever-changing ball game. And as long as we continue to identify the gaps and work hard to fill those gaps in, I think we can stay on top of this with our community.
Yeah, and I only mentioned it briefly too, but you actually are dealing with this on two sides. You're dealing with or two positive sides, if you will. You're dealing with people when they're coming out of the jail or incarceration that need help. But the other hat that we only briefly talked about that you're involved in is the drug court. It's basically dealing with people who can work some things out as opposed to being incarcerated.
Well, and it's now that we've changed our system at Drug and Alcohol Services to a levels of care system, you know, the drug court falls in there and this post-release treatment system falls in at different levels with level one treatment. And with different levels of care, we can put people where they need to be to best suit their needs, which is what's really neat about all this.
Okay, and that doesn't even count some things that are not being done as extensively as what you're doing yet, which is things like the Veterans Court program and some other things that we're working on the county level, I guess.
Right. And, yeah. And you know, a lot of people see, well, they've got a bunch of grants and they go for all these funding. Well, every time we go for something, we're trying to fill a gap. We're trying to plug a crack.
Yeah, it's great.
I'll just wrap up, Fred, to kind of – I was just going to mention Prop 47. I know we mentioned about it at the very beginning, and I think that's a whole nother challenge, and it's probably a whole nother show, to be quite honest with you.
When you get an email from us and you say you're coming back, it's like, oh, didn't they already ask me?
We've talked about the positives, but Prop 47 has had some significant impacts on the programming we've been put out, and they're not positive impacts on what we've been doing with AB 109 and where we're heading. We took a big step back with Prop 47, unfortunately.
Okay. Then we'll jump to it. I'm sorry we didn't get a chance to get into that today. But, our producer listens to the program very carefully, and you'll be hearing from her about doing another program with that, too. So this has been Central Coast Voices, and I thank you for being part of what we're talking about today. This has been an exciting program. As I've reminded you before, Central Coast Voices is a production of Action for Healthy Communities, which is a project of the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County. Next week, join Chris Kington Barker, who will be talking about a very important and frankly underreported topic. According to the Justice Department survey, more than 1 million women are stalked annually in the U.S., and she's going to be meeting with Tracy Weber, who's a deputy city attorney for the city of Los Angeles and a counselor with the Child Abuse Policy Council and Cybercrime Prosecution, try that again, and Cal Poly's director of the SAFER program, Christina Caviani, and they're going to talk about basically cyber stalking, reverse porn, and emerging issues regarding that have come up for a lot of people, and it's scary information, but you need to know about it. And that'll be Chris here with you next week. Central Coast Voices is produced in collaboration, as I've said, with KCBX, and we thank Joan Gillard Sargent for underwriting the program. You can reach us at 543-2323 with your ideas. This has been Central Coast Voices. Thanks for joining us.